As a small business owner, have you ever felt overwhelmed by the pressure of choosing the right hire or leading a team? Or have you ever found yourself tolerating a bad hire because you fear trying and failing again as you repeat the hiring process? If so, you're not alone, and you are in the right place. Welcome to the Growing Your Team podcast. The Growing Your Team podcast teaches business owners like you to expand your unique business by teaching you to master the hiring and team management process. Hiring and managing a team does not have to be a challenge. You just have to learn to do it right. And the Growing Your Team podcast teaches you how to become a confident leader who hires right every single time. Now, let's jump into the show where each episode you will learn tips on how to identify what type of help you need on your team, how to source amazing candidates, how to conduct interviews that lead you to your ideal team member, how to onboard successfully, and how to lead every person in your business so you have a team of rock stars who you are happy to pay every single paycheck. So let's jump in and teach you how to hire like a pro. Hello, Jamie Van Kuyk here, and welcome back to the Growing Your Team podcast. Today, I have on guest Mike Michalowicz. By his 35th birthday, Mike had founded and sold two multi-million dollar companies. Confident that he had identified the formula for success, Mike became a small business angel investor and proceeded to lose his entire fortune. Then he started all over again, driven to find better ways to grow healthy and strong companies. Mike has devoted his life to the research and delivery of innovative, impactful entrepreneurial strategies. In his latest book, All In, which just launched in January of 2024, he offers transformative leadership strategies that nurture talent and create top performers. And isn't that what we all want? Top performers in our organization. And in order to get top performers, we first need to be able to afford top performers, and we also then need to be able to identify those top performers in our hiring process. So today, Mike and I are digging into those two concepts. As mentioned, Mike is all about delivering the research that he finds, and he does this in a number of books. And so we are talking about two of his core books today. The first one, Profit First, where we'll dive into some of the strategies and everything that is needed so you can afford the team members that you want. And talk a little bit about how if you can't quite afford the team member that you fully want, what are some different options that you can do based on the money you actually have available? And then we're going to talk about how to find those new team members by talking all about how to nurture talent and everything from hearing some tips from his new book, All In. So let's jump into the conversation so you can hear all about Mike's wisdom and get a little preview into some of the information that you will learn if you go out and purchase and read his books, which trust me, I have a handful of them. I think they are fantastic. And I highly encourage you, if you're as a small business owner, to have some of these on your shelf as well. Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Growing Your Team podcast.
Hi, Jamie. Hi, from up north of you. It's good to be here.
Yes. I am so excited to have you on the show. Can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I'm outside New York and I'm flying down to Florida. I wish to see you, but instead for a business trip, the cold weather. So the quick background on me, I'm an entrepreneur myself. I've been an entrepreneur my entire adult life. I've experienced some amazing peaks. I've sold a couple of businesses and so forth, but also these deep valleys. I lost everything, including my house, just not knowing what to do, but thinking I did. You know, it's called arrogance and ignorance.
Right.
Felt a calling. I feel I'm called to write. So today I do own multiple businesses. I do have teams. My author company has 8 employees. I have another company with 15 employees. So small businesses. And I'm researching and trying to find all of the answers to things I thought I knew that I didn't. At the end of the day, I believe that a teacher is the ultimate student. So I feel compelled to find how to make my business profitable, how to have a team that acts like owners and all these different things. And then when I find something, I test in my own businesses. And if it is profound and has a transformative effect on my business, I feel compelled to share with other people. So I put in a book and write books.
Yes. Yes. I love that. And okay. So here's what I was so excited to share about at first, but you know, before you gave your introduction is I just wanted to kind of take a moment and kind of fangirl a little bit and tell you about how Profit First really changed me and my business.
Oh, I love hearing that.
And so it was one of those concepts, and we've talked about Profit First a few times with different guests on this podcast. But if you're listening and you don't know what it is, go buy the book. You're going to love it. But anyway, so I heard a little bit about it in like different Facebook groups and business forums or people, as soon as anyone asked any question about money, they're like, go read Profit First, read it. And finally, I'm just like, okay, let me read it. Like, let me hear what all the hype is about.
Yeah.
And when I say it changed my business, like that really has to be an understatement. I realized I was strangling my business financially because in those early stages, you don't really have a whole lot of revenue coming in. So my mindset was, I don't have a whole lot of money, don't spend the money. And then reading that book and really figuring out how to properly allocate the dollars that were coming in, I started spending money that I should be spending and my business just took off.
Yeah. It's interesting. So you are, if I may suggest, wired to behave a certain way because every human is, myself, everyone listening, and it's based upon a concept called Parkinson's Law. So a quick history lesson, if I may.
Yeah.
Okay. In the 1950s, there's this theorist, Northcote Parkinson's his name. By the way, nothing to do with Parkinson's disease. And he's studying human behavior. And he found that the traditional supply-demand curve is total nonsense. What the traditional supply-demand curve is something we've all been taught. The more demand there is for something, the more supply will occur. So the more people who want your services, the more you're going to do it. And if you can't do it, your competition will supply. And it does make sense in certain unique circumstances. But when it comes to human behavior, whereas his research was, he said that curve is totally wrong. It's the reverse. It's supply that's dictating demand, meaning the more available a resource is, the more we consume it. And the classic study is around time. So the more time I'm given to do something, it takes me longer to do it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the more in societally, it's the fact plates, servings of food, portions have gotten bigger and bigger. You know, soda cans, you see how big they're now? They're like these bazookas you carry around.
Right.
Like, it's unbelievable. 15 years ago, it was a 16 ounce or whatever it was. And before that, it was half the size of that. But our consumption, we consume the entire can. So our behavior just to supply. And it's true for money too. And that's the challenge for businesses. As our revenue grows, like we see it growing, deposits over time get bigger, our spend at the exact same rate increases. And most people are like, how can this be? I'm growing, but I'm not profitable. Why am I not getting there? And it's a natural human wiring. So what happens with Profit First, we take our profit first, we hide the money from ourselves, it constrains the money. So it reduces the size of that soda can, it makes it smaller. So now you have to drink out of a smaller container. And there's no miracle here. When there's less supply, you're forced to be frugal. But more than that, you start becoming innovative. You're like, how do I drive the results I want without this money? Because I don't have the money. And we start thinking about our business in a new way. We become strategic. We start to truly leverage and scale. And so that's why I'm happy it's working for you. But I'm also not surprised because it's how you and I and we are all wired.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's so great. Like for me, like I said, I was strangling my business without even realizing it because I was so afraid to spend the dollars and then realizing I can afford that system that is going to save me time. I can afford that coach that's going to give me insight that I don't have because this is the first business I've ever started. And all those things where it's like, I can do this. And then later looking at opportunities and things coming up and saying, you know what, that's great, but I can't afford it right now. So we'll put it on that list of things that we'll revisit later as the revenue continues to grow. And there's more to play with in that bucket.
it moves the can to the should. Like, yeah, I can do this, but should I do this? Now it forces that hard conversation. I'm curious, in your business, have you started accumulating cash? Is there a reserve? And if that's the case, or even in your personal life, has your mental state shifted?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Definitely. How? It's one of those things, because you see the possibilities, you see the things that you want to do in the future, and you're like, this is possible. You know, when you talk about kind of that reserve, it's one of the things I always talk about with a lot of people when it goes to hiring their team members, because they always say, I don't know if I can afford this team member, or I see the impact that this team member should have on my business. But let's say for a sales position, for example, it takes a while for that salesperson to really get to know the business, to be able to start going out and making those sales and producing that revenue. I always say every position should be able to pay for itself, but it takes a little bit of time to get there. So when I start being able to build that reserve, it's like, this is what I'm going to be able to do, because I can pay for it before it starts to bring in the revenue that I know it's going to bring in once it's there.
I love that. I love that perspective, because that's what happens for us. There's a specific strategy within Profit First for a hire. So in Profit First, the foundational principle is we allocate money toward profit, which is to reward the owner. We save money to pay the owner their salary, which is different than profit. But there's a special technique, because the most common dilemma small business has when it comes to hiring is, can I cash flow this? Can I afford this person? And we don't know. So what we do in Profit First, we say, well, when you do hire this person inevitably, what do you believe their compensation will be? What do you plan for? And let's just pick a number. We'll say $50,000 a year. Okay. If that's the number, what we do then is we start allocating money starting immediately to an account called new employee. Like, we actually set up a bank account as new employee, and we start paying this account the equivalent of the $50,000 a year. Within 3 or 4 months, we say, okay, we can handle this cash flow. It didn't stress out the business, or it does. If it does stress out the business, you're not ready to hire the person on a cash flow basis. If it doesn't stress the company, now you have this reserve of cash that's built up. And when you make this hire, you have 4 months of cash reserved. So now it's not this panic, like, you're on board, you got to sell today, or you got to get up to speed. We have runway. So it proves it before you do it. And when you do it, you have a reserve for the future. So it's much more smooth, you know?
Yeah. And especially with small businesses, a lot of times we don't have huge training teams. So when we bring someone on, we have to take some of our own time to train that person, which potentially means that's time that we're not generating revenue ourselves.
Yeah.
So having to have that reserve there that can help, maybe help with that possible dip in revenue as you're putting time and effort into this new employee, helps to make sure that you can afford it, that you feel comfortable, that you're not going to go in the red or feel like you're going to go bankrupt and have to close down because you're hiring. So it gives you a lot of power that you didn't know you had without it.
How many folks do you have on your team, by the way?
So my team right now, employee wise, is just me, and I work with a bunch of contractors as needed for projects.
So contractors, and it's interesting, today's business model is that is your team, right? So when I ask people how big your team, I guess just me, and then they list off 6 contractors. Oh, you got 6 folks working for you, or they have vendors. You know, the company providing the software technology, those are companies that you're paying a fee to provide a service. That's like an employee. So teams are much more amoebic, you know, adjusts and stuff over time now. And we have to see it differently. What's interesting is, if you hire an internal employee, one person that comes on board, maybe full time, that's 50% growth of your internal staff. It's you plus one. And that is a dramatic increase in volume of people on a percentage basis. If I look at Google, which I think has 100,000 employees, it would be unfathomable that they announce saying, tomorrow, we're going to hire 100% more employees. We're going to hire 100,000 more people. We'd be like, oh my God, the burden on the company. Well, that's the exact same growth of a one person going to 2 people, or 100,000 going to 200,000. The impact is dramatic, because we have to bring this person up. We have to bring half the company up to speed. We have to have half the company understand what's going on. So what I invite people to do is, when you're considering growth, can we fractionalize it? Instead of bringing on that first employee, the full-time employee, can they come on as a contractor that works 1 hour a week? Can we hire someone that's a part-timer, so that it's not this abrupt shift to the business? It has an impact financially, but it also has an impact in the culture and so many other elements of the business, you know?
Yes, I love that you brought that up, because I go through conversations like that all the time. People are like, I need help. but I can't afford full time, or I don't have enough work for full time. And I was just like, wait, we don't need to jump into a full time employee right away. You can start off with someone helping you 5 hours a week on a project by project basis, all these different things to really get the help that you need based on where your business is now. And as your business continues to grow and change, then you hire the help that your business needs then in the future.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it's interesting too, the cultural shift. So we were talking off the air, but I have a new book out, and I know it sounds pluggy. It's called All In, but what's significant in this, I discovered that many businesses achieve a siloing effect unintentionally. We set a cultural standard. We say, this is how my values are, and therefore I have an expectation other people meet my values. As I grow this organization, we have everyone that has complementary values. Well, the problem is it's a silo effect. It's basically saying, this is how I am. I need people just like me to affirm to be just like me. And what we put out there echoes back to us. It's interesting, my research on the healthiest, strongest companies, they intentionally seek value diversity. I have different perspectives. I have different beliefs. I have different backgrounds. And now it brings what's called perspective. And I call this, instead of focusing on culture, we focus on community. I think in my own town here, there's a diverse group of people, different genders, of course, and different ages and different races and different backgrounds and different religions and different experiences. And that brings this vibrant life to the community and brings this perspective that no one individual or cloned individual could bring about. So I'm encouraging businesses, let's seek that diversity to bring that perspective, which actually brings the most strength.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely agree there. One of the things that I always say is, like, when we're doing that, people think, all right, I need someone that's complete opposite of mine. How do I manage? How do I lead that person? And I say there's a difference sometimes between getting that person that is the opposite of you in skills or maybe thought and things like that, but still making sure that you have the ability to work with and manage that person.
Yeah.
So you don't need to go with someone that's going to drive you crazy every day. You still need someone that's going to fit, especially a small business where it might be you and that person at first. It might be you and two others. Like, you need someone that fits with your management style and the culture that you're creating, but having that thing where that person's not just you. Like, even when we talk about hiring a junior you as one of the possibilities of what type of position do you bring on, it doesn't mean cloning yourself. It just means they're doing some of the work to deliver to a client that you were previously doing.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine coming to work every day saying, gosh, I loathe this person I work with. We are at such odds and conflict. Well, that won't work. There's no question about it. Conversely, coming to the office and looking in the mirror and saying, should we do this? And the mirror looking at you saying, should we do this? It's such an echo that everything is right. So what we want to do is find people that have a different approach, a different style that complements us, particularly in the areas that is not our talent. I call it the I can syndrome. And what I noticed in myself and so many businesses I help or observed in their growth, the entrepreneur says, well, I can do the accounting. I can do this. I can do that. And in early stage business, when it's a micro enterprise, it's us. You have to do everything. It's not that you can, you must. But then the question is, can you do this at an excellent degree? Is this your super talent? And that's where we have to start admitting, I can do the accounting. I kind of suck at it and I don't really pay much attention to it. And there's probably errors in there, but I don't pay attention to it. Well, that's not super talent. Then what we have to do is start fractionalizing ourselves. So what I do with myself is I use a calendar to do this, but I track every minute of the day. Like the conversation we're having today is being tracked. And I allocated 35 minutes. And if we finish in 30 minutes, I'm going to go back and adjust it to 30 minutes. So I can, in reflection, look back, how much time did I invest here? Where's my talent and contribution? And I'll find there's things I'm doing throughout the day that, I can do. I just can't do well. And those are the people that I need to hire. Those are the fractions of me I need to get off of my plate, so to speak, and give to someone else who has a talent there. And to your earlier point, not hiring full-time people. Not anymore. It's finding a contractor perhaps to do it, or someone that wants to work part-time, or maybe it is an existing full-time person that has a better talent than you do and can elevate it until you bridge it over again to someone else, you know?
Yeah. I totally agree there. And I track my time too. I do it a lot more now than I did before, but It is so eye-opening to see
it really is.
Where my time is going versus where it should be spent going. Like one of the contractors that I work with is marketing, and she's only with me a few hours a week. And we were just talking about like, okay, soon, hopefully I'll be able to increase your hours, because I'm looking at my time and I'm still spending way too much time doing marketing tasks myself. And that's not my area of expertise. Some of the stuff, there's no reason I should be doing it. But I would never really realize that whole impact if I wasn't tracking my time.
Yeah. I want to share some with you, because we're talking about these people, and I suspect someone may be listening right now and say, maybe you and I, you know, how do you find this person? Like, I need this person, but how do I find someone that has this super talent here? And a big piece of research I did when writing All In, I found something that it totally changed my position on how we find people. So here's how I do all my research. I ask, what is the desire that we have in any circumstance? So when it comes to hiring people, I want an A player or top performer. You know, those are the common labels, which, by the way, I'm not a fan of those. I don't like labeling. I don't think that's a smart move, but let's just say A player. Then I ask, what's the methodology we follow? And the methodology is, I do interviews. Well, what's the outcome? And I look at the data, and the data indicates less than 5% of people that we hire end up being long-term, that's over, considered over 5 years now, long-term employees who perform at exceptional levels, less than 10%, less than 5%. You know, it's such a low number. Mm-hmm. So when I say the desire and the outcome is such a mismatch, it's the method that's wrong. So I'm like, okay, interviews don't work. Let's not keep doing this. It's going to amplify the problem. The question, of course, is what works? Well, in my research, I found a $500 billion, that's trillion with a T, industry that doesn't do an interview. They do a whole other assessment. They find the best talent and they recruit the best talent. And the industry is sports. You don't, if you're going to play a sport, you don't head up to the field and the coach is like, oh, just show me your resume. Let's go. Where is the red on a traffic light, top or bottom? They don't do that stuff. They say, let's get on the field. Let's play a little bit. Let's observe you.
Right.
Observation is the indicator, not interviews. So here's how we can do it in business. Home Depot does this. The next time you see a build a birdhouse workshop, it is a recruiting platform. Here's the key. Make it an educational opportunity. So people who are curious in something will seek out education or advancement. So want to build a birdhouse? The only people that want to build a birdhouse are people who are curious about building a birdhouse, doing something with their child or whatever it is, but they want this engaging activity. Curiosity is the ultimate vetting mechanism. Then when you go there, they watch for two indicators. One's called desire. Desire is where you ask questions. That's usually how the behavior is. You support other people. You're engaged. The other highest level is called thirst. Thirst is where you can't stop doing it. It's the person says, can I build another birdhouse? Do you mind if I say a little bit later? The Home Depot staff is teaching and one person is observing. And they watch and they say, well, that person is showing desire and thirst. Tap them on the shoulder. Hey, we're looking for people just like you to work at Home Depot. Have you ever considered working here? Here's an application. This is a powerful method that so many small businesses could be doing, but they don't. Run workshops. Now, I'll give you an example. Say you're looking to hire that marketing person and you want a marketing person that has already some experience under their belt, but you want to hire them. What would be a technique or a tool they could advance in? So maybe it's TikTok marketing. So what you do is you run a workshop, not build a birdhouse, but you say, learn TikTok marketing. And by the way, if you don't know how to do it, that's fine. Hire someone that can do TikTok marketing. Then what you do is say, we're going to charge $100 and you can learn TikTok marketing. The reason, now, instead of you telling people it's an interview, you're educating them, you should charge them because curiosity, people will vet themselves out when there's effort. I got to drive down to Home Depot or I got to spend $100 for supplies or I got to make an investment. So that's a great first filter. Then as you're educating, everyone's getting better. Everyone's learning the skill. So you're serving the entire candidate group, but you also start observing who are the best participants. And those are the ones you tap on the shoulder. So everyone comes out better, but you get a cherry pick. And here's the last little tip. Even that may feel overwhelming. I got to put on a workshop. Do I do this virtually and so forth? I'll give you the ultimate hack. If you need to hire a marketing person, go in this example to someone that already is doing a TikTok workshop as a student, specifically to observe the other students. So you go as a student and you watch and say, who's the most engaged? I should tap on the shoulder and say, hey, you want to do this at my company for me? And the beauty of this is you're no longer looking at the small candidate pool of people who happen to be looking for a job. You're looking at the massive candidate pool of people who are looking to advance themselves. These are people that are often employed elsewhere, but are looking to advance themselves, who are the best performers for that need. Those people come to these classes and you get to cherry pick the best fits for your business.
Yeah, I really like that concept. Now, as someone that helps our clients write interview guides and do interviews, let's not get rid of the interview for everything, but I definitely see that, because I've actually given similar advice to people. I've had a few clients that come to me in certain fields where I know just from experience, the normal posting a job on a job board and getting people to apply and then go, it just doesn't work. It is not good. And I was just like, as I tell them, I was like, you need to create kind of that demand and know who you want to hire before you go to hire them. So what about offering classes, especially if you're in a field where continuing education is either a requirement, and of course, then sometimes you need to be certified to do that continuing education, or it's a thing where you really want the people that care about that continuing education, even if they're not getting formal credit for it. So it's like, when you create those workshops, when you create those classes, you then, one, get people to know about your business, because if you're a small business, you might get overshadowed sometimes by larger corporations. And two, you get to know who you want to hire before you ever post that job, before you ever have that opening. And I've had people where that has worked for them, because posting on a job board never really produced the right candidates.
Audible is doing what you're suggesting, the blend of interviews and performance-based kind of workshops or skill assessments. And they've created this thing called returnships, as opposed to internships, returnships. And they say, if you have left the professional workforce for over a couple of years, generally because of, you know, COVID or an illness or whatever, and are re-entering the workforce, but are unfamiliar with the technology today because it's advancing so quickly, we have an opportunity for a returnship. Now, you have to qualify through an interview process. And what they're doing is they're getting a historical assessment on you. And history can be an indicator of the future. They said, once you pass the interviews, then you're going to work with us for 12 weeks. And after 12 weeks, it's over, but you're going to learn all the skills and we're going to observe you and coach you along. Audible has a 50% higher rate from these returnships. It's extraordinary. So they're using the interview for vetting people. Interviews are amazing for vetting people's interest. You know, when I ran ads on Indeed or whatever, when I get responses, I'm always blown away how many people never read the ad in the first place, because it's low effort. It's just click. One thing I did in my ads, I make these super long ads, I'd bury near the last paragraph saying, if you actually are reading this entire ad, include the code words, I read the entire ad, in the subject line of the email in response so I can vet you out. And about 5% of people pass that test. Interviews are a great test to show commitment. And that's how Audible is using it. And then it has a skills assessment over 12 weeks. But the interesting thing is every person, again, comes out improved. You're serving your audience. Half the people aren't a fit for Audible, but they've advanced themselves and are a fit elsewhere now, or a better fit, because they've improved their skills.
Yeah. Do you want to know what I absolutely love about that is I always say we are responsible for creating the workforce that we want, where a lot say, I want the person that's highly skilled and experienced, but I'm not willing to help the person become highly skilled and experienced. I want someone else to do it for me. And that's a method there where they're getting the employees that they want, but they're also helping these people then become the people other people want to hire, because they have that 12 weeks of knowledge and stuff. They have that refresher and everything. So I always say we have to figure out a way of how do we help the workforce be what we need it to be? We can't depend on everybody else to do it for us.
Yeah, that's the absolute truth. That's the absolute truth. One other thing I wanted to share about building the workforce, I just feel compelled to share these tips, is I remember one day I was coming out of my own office trying to get my workforce motivated, how to get my employees to act like owners. And I calculated the numbers. I had a forensics business. We did a crime investigation, computer forensics specifically. I had 30 employees and I ran the numbers. We can do $10 million this year. I came out of the office. I put in, you know, big bubble letters on the wall, a whiteboard, $10 million. I hit it with a post-it note so I could reveal the number, called everyone in, queued up Eye of the Tiger. It was like a total cheesy setup. But I was like so excited. And with great flair, I rip off the post-it note saying, this is the year we achieved $10 million in revenue. This is the vision for our company. Yeah. And everyone's like, meh, and kind of slumped away. I'm like, what's going on? We have such a clear vision. There's clear steps to get there. And my assistant at the time, her name was Patty, came up and said, Mike, that's your vision. What about our personal visions? I was like, what do you mean? She goes, you know, there's someone here who's looking to buy their first house. There's someone else that wants to learn to speak Spanish. I'm like, oh my God. the vision of an organization is not the vision of an organization. It's the vision of the owner or leader. That's our dream. That $10 million does feed my ego. It means something to me, an accomplishment. But my colleague getting their first house, my other colleague learning Spanish. When I, as a leader, started to prioritize their personal visions, they started to prioritize the corporate vision, my vision. So when I said, hey, how's that house going? What can I do to block and tackle for you? Can I introduce you to a real estate agent? When I kept their vision in front of them, it kept on saying, you got to get there. Let's do this. When I cared so much about their vision, they started to care about my vision. And sure enough, the business started to push forward. The traditional vision is, you know, the leader pointing forward, the George Washington in the front of the boat pointing and everyone rowing behind. I think the reality now is us locking arms and walking in step, synchronized together, and everyone achieving what their goals are.
Oh, yes. Like, as we're going to record this, I think it was like 2-3 weeks ago, I had a podcast episode that went out where I specifically kind of talked about that. It was like, as you're going to set your goals for the year and communicating your goals, your employees don't care about your goals. They care about what's in it for them. So you need to make sure you are addressing the what's in it for them, because they don't care that you hit a certain revenue number, especially if they're not going to get a raise at the end of the day. They don't care that you sign that extra client if it means more work for them and less recognition. You know, so it's like trying to always think what's in it for your team, because that's how you get them to rally behind you and help cheer on those goals and help do the work.
So there's a great book. I wish I had written it by a guy named Matthew Kelly called Dream Manager. And it's this whole concept of identifying the what's in it for them. What do people want for themselves? What do we all want for ourselves? And how to make this a process where a company can help not fulfill dreams, because that's gifting. You know, if someone wants to buy a house, if I give them a house, that may feel good in the moment, but there's no sense of journey. There's no sense of accomplishment. There's significance in the journey. So our job is not to fulfill dreams. It's to keep them preeminent for each person. So the book is called Dream Manager by Matthew Kelly.
Yeah, I think I actually have that book back here on the shelf somewhere. Awesome. One of those ones where I have, but I have not read yet. So it's on the list.
It's a great book.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay. So we're talking about kind of like this what's in it for them.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of brings back to some of the motivation. And I'm assuming that probably helps lead to good retention. Have you seen that?
Oh, no question about it. So I have practical in-person experience. Our business here, like I said, I think it's shared. We have about 8 folks here. People have been here not just for a long time, but they have a strong presence, meaning they're engaged. And quite a few of the team members here worked at other companies. And the feedback, again, it's a small business. There's advantages in small business over large corporations, and some folks were at large corporations. Large corporations are often, can be, fill in the blank. We need this person, insert in blank. Small business can be much more inclusive. There's a lot more opportunity to do more things. And the feedback here consistently is, I've never been cared for. I've never been so important before for an organization. And the nature of reciprocity is people respond in kind. But we also started a company. We call it the All In Company, which is at allincompany.com. And our organization goes into businesses of all size, bigger small businesses, usually 10 employees or more, sometimes large corporations, and institute programs that engage the employee fully. We do this program of vision setting for individuals and having that habitually addressed. Every Monday, for example, here at our office, we're talking about our individual goals. But there's something even greater, and it's this concept of psychological ownership. Psychological ownership is the feeling of ownership. It's different than legal ownership. Legal ownership is contractual ownership, but it often, without psychological ownership, results in entitlement. You owe me. So many ESOP programs have failed because the employees now own the business. They're like, well, where's my money? They have to be psychologically invested. So we focus on the psychological component. And the classic example is with a car. If you rent a car, you have the right to use it, but you're told you must comply with these rules, return with a full tank of gas, or we'll charge you $10 a gallon. There's all these penalties. And we have a simple saying, when forced to comply, people will seek to defy. Many leaders say, here's the regimen of rules. These are your roles and responsibilities. You better do this. I'm going to measure it. And if you fail, there's punitive costs. You may get fired, or you may get may not get a promotion. And if you succeed, maybe you'll be rewarded. That's a compliance defiance scenario. Instead, we want to deploy psychological ownership. When I own my car, I have a pickup truck, and what gives me the sense of ownership is I can personalize it. I program the radio stations. I can put a bumper sticker on it. I have intimate knowledge. I know what every bell, buzz, whistle, everything does. And I have control. I can park it where I want to park it. I can use it when I want to use it. And here's the funny thing. I said I own it. Actually, I don't own it. The bank owns it. I'm making my installments. So I don't have legal ownership of the vehicle yet. I'm making my payments, but I have psychological ownership. So the irony is we don't need our employees to have an ESOP or to legally own part of our business. We simply need to give them the ability to personalize the work they're doing, have control over its direction, and give them the opportunity to gain intimate knowledge around it. And then you have the sense of ownership.
Yes. It's all about putting the authority and responsibility where it belongs and
trying
to take that from them, but have them do all the work.
I couldn't have said better. That's exactly it.
Yes. It also, like, another example of kind of what you were talking about there, it reminds me is, so we own a short-term rental. And before we did, we heard a lot of horror stories about people just leaving places a mess and people complaining about the rule, like the cleaning checkout rules and everything. And we made the decision. We're like, listen, our only request is on the day you leave is that you lock all the doors, the windows are closed, and the lights are off. That's it.
Yeah.
I don't care what else you do. Every person that has left, every piece of garbage is in a garbage can. They take the garbage out. There's not a dish in the sink. Like, the towels are either nicely in the laundry room or someplace. Like, they leave the place spotless, but I don't require them to do. I'm not telling them to do anything. My message to them for checkout is, this is your last morning of vacation. Enjoy it. You know? And, but they take their ownership because they don't feel forced to do anything.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's the old compliance defiance. We've seen it over and over again where businesses that are not achieving the results they want, they come down with more force. We're going to make sure that everyone's working 40 hours a week. We're going to make sure you're doing this. We need to have time logs and check-ins. Often it results in unintended consequences. I did a study of a major corporation called M&M Mars. I cannot tell my source because the source is not to be revealed. It's a journalistic interview. But they ran a program that we identified years ago that was called the Punk Bonus, P-U-N-C, stood for Punctuality Bonus, but came to known as the Punk Bonus. And they required this adherence that if you had to show up, say it was 8 o'clock in the morning or before, and check in. And what they were trying to do was reward it, that if you arrived before 8 o'clock, the check-in, you could get a 5% punctuality bonus at the end of the day. But what was interesting is it resulted in unintended consequences, which is the big risk. They're forcing compliance, even though it felt like it was the right thing. They forced compliance. They said, if you're not here after eight, there's a penalty. You're not getting a bonus. So there's the other side. So what do people start doing? Well, they start building these coalitions and saying, hey, why don't you get there early and check me in for me, right? We're going to build this bond. So now the company says, this is happening. We're going to get a security guard watching people, making sure they're only checking in themselves. So now it becomes authoritative, punitive. Right. So now what do people start doing? Now it's like, how closely can I carve it to 8 o'clock? Well, you have a surge of people arriving at 7:59. Now there's pushing and shoving to get in front of the line, because if you miss 8 o'clock, you miss the bonus. So now fights are breaking out, arguments, hopefully no fist fights.
Right.
And then people that are not getting penalized start getting angry that didn't make it at 8 o'clock. They're getting angry that they're not getting a bonus. It was an abject failure. That's called unintended consequences. Unintended consequences is where we have a vision for an achievement or goal, but we set structure around it that has these consequences that actually generate, in some cases, the absolute opposite. Usually when there's a force of authority, when we're mandating something, there's going to be a stream of unintended consequences that we have to watch out for. So the better thing is what you did. If you can do it with no rules, you'll actually usually get better compliance towards your objective. We're all humans after all. We'll probably get more than if we have to use authority. Authority can work. It's just risky, and watch out for those unintended consequences.
I love that example. Yeah, I'm just reminded of one of the teams that I managed back in corporate. They were by far the best team I ever managed. And some other managers, they would be like, why don't you have these problems on your team that they were having on their team? And I was like, because I treat my team like adults. Yeah. Like, they bring problems to me, but I'm not solving them for them. We sometimes solve them together because they do need my input. Sometimes they're just, but they got to a point where sometimes when they bring me the problems, it's just like, hey, Jamie, I just want to make you aware that this is happening. This is what we're doing to solve it. You know, we just want to keep you in the loop. And I was like, and I don't have to do it for them, where you've trained your team that if they have a problem, you are the problem solver and they can't do anything without you. So now they come to you because you took that authority away from them. You took that responsibility away from them. Yeah. And now you're dealing with the consequences.
Totally. Yeah, I love doing research. And there was another book I was writing called Clockwork. And the subtitle is Design Your Business to Run Itself. You know, how does a business owner get a company to operate in their absence? And the one component that was perhaps the most impact was the bite your tongue moment. And what this is when we give authority, control, ownership to a colleague, they may not make a decision that's congruent with what we wanted, which we, as a leader or owner of business, we often think our decisions are the best. So they're not compliant with the high standard that we set. So what many business owners do is they then assert themselves and say, whoa, hold on. Interesting that you have an idea, but that's not the best idea. Here's the way we do things down the farm. We're going to do it our way. It actually strips that person of having control and authority, and it hampers the relationship. So the bite the tongue is when a person comes and says, I have an idea, and you don't think it's a good idea, better bite your tongue and say, I support it. The ultimate form of delegation is not giving responsibility. It's allowing people to follow the path of their own choosing without you inserting yourself. And it will require you to bite your tongue. Because what happens then is sometimes that person will do something that they discover on their own is not working. And now they're in the position to correct it. That's how learning happens. Now, here's the greatest irony. As a business owner, that's what we do for ourselves. We F up all the time. And we're like, right? Oh, we don't fire ourselves. We're like, oh, that was dumb. And we continue on. And we are the ultimate owners of our businesses, legally in this case, but also psychologically. When our colleagues are allowed to make mistakes and recover and find ways without negative consequence, when we treat them like we treat ourselves, then they start to grow to the highest levels.
Yeah. As I always train people, I say, because I said so is not an answer. So it's like, before you go to correct them, before you tell them that that's the wrong way, think about why is it the wrong way? And if all you can think of is because I said so, that's the way I like it. No, let them do it on their own. There are times where they might not be aware of compliance issues, contract specifics, things like that, where it's like, there's things where, okay, if we do that, we're not meeting our obligation that we've told people we would, or we're going to be in trouble with regulators or things like that. There's things that, yes, things have to be done a certain way, but there's also things that's like, we just want it done that way. And we have to let go and we have to allow people to create their own way that will get to the intended results.
Absolutely love that. 100% agree.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, we have to start wrapping up a little bit. So before we do that, you have your new book All In that is out. So quick overview.
Sure.
Who is this book really intended for? If they're saying, I have this problem, I need some help and guidance on how to fix it or advice on where to go. Who are those people that should be picking up your book, ordering it today?
Okay. If you're a business owner or a business leader, and you have struggles with recruiting, retaining, or raising the bar with your team, if you want to recruit A players, again, I don't like that label necessarily, but if the best talent, if you had trouble retaining the best talent or raising the bar for the folks that work with you, and this isn't just employees, right? This is contractors, this is anyone that works on your team. I wrote this book for you. And what I discovered in this research, it was 5 years of research and codifying the system as a lot of contrarian ideas. Interviews alone are not effective. We found you need to complement it with other components. Interviews are good, but not alone. The concept of a player may be a little bit off. What we discovered is everyone is an A player. Even the person that you think is struggling with every element of life is an A player when put in the right environment. So it's about getting the perfect matches. Everyone has A potential, maybe not with your company. And that's the key. We talk about this concept of psychological ownership over legal ownership and how psychological ownership can be driven to really raise the bar for an organization. We even talk about things like safety. There are safety concerns from the physical safety to psychological safety to relational safety that leaders, business owners can manage in the most simple way. My own office, 8 people here, we had a physical safety concern. I had no idea. We ran a survey and people said there's an alleyway behind our building where you walk to the parking lot. It's dark. And I said, I don't like walking down a dark alley. I feel physically threatened even though I don't know what's there. And so starting at 2 or 3 in the afternoon when the sun starts coming down by 5 o'clock in the winter, it gets dark here. People are afraid and thinking about leaving the building. Oh my gosh. So we installed a lighting system and now that's been alleviated. So we got to look at those elements too. I call it at the end of the day, FASO, fit, which is, we talked about the match, ability. We talked about assessing ability. Interviews are great for experiential ability, but there's these potential assessments through workshops. What's your potential ability? Innate ability. There's things like Enneagram, and those are great tools too. Then we talk about safety and ultimately psychological ownership.
Yeah, love that. Ooh, can't wait to get my hands on it and finish reading it and everything. So I do love you talk about just because someone's an A player does not mean they're the A player for your organization, yeah. Which totally echoes one of the things I say all the time is just because someone's good at what they do does not mean they're right for you.
Oh, good.
So let's
rhyme.
Focus on getting the right people into those positions. And I think like it's one of those things we're trained. There's a lot of times in corporate speak, they tell you, get the person on the bus and you can find them the right seat. And I would say it doesn't work for small businesses because sometimes you're in a two-seater convertible.
Right, exactly.
There is no other seat for them.
Your bus is called a moped. You're driving a moped. Yeah, so, that's a good point.
Moped with a sidecar, that's your contractor that's helping you out, that's there sometimes not. Like there's no other seats. So you have to find the right person that's right for you at that time in your business. And you know, it sounds like your book has a lot of ways to help them find that person, ideas, ways to improve their hiring process and improve their retention and everything. So people are happy. They feel valued.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's all in there. I honestly do feel it's the deepest and best research I've done. I hope it really serves a lot of people. It's available, you know, at your favorite bookstore, Amazon, all those things.
Good, good. All right, Mike, how can everybody get in touch with you?
Yeah, me. So I'll give you a shortcut. My last name is Michalowicz, and it's hard to pronounce. It's impossible to spell. So my website
is
it's Mike Motorbike, as in the motorcycle. It's a nickname from grade school and it rhymes and it's the only PG nickname I've ever had. So MikeMotorbike.com. I've written now 9 business books. They're all available, free chapter downloads for them. I just write for the Wall Street Journal. You can get that content and also my own podcast. So MikeMotorbike.com.
That's great. Yeah. And for your books, like, I know some books, business books out there, they're a bore to read. And you're like, the content in here might be good, but oh my gosh, I can't get through this. Like your books, they're written in a way that they're enjoyable. You get it out there. Like you write in a great format. So yes,
thank you.
If those listening, if you haven't read any of his books, go get your hand on ones, especially All In.
Thank you so much.
All right. So the final question that I love to ask all my guests, we've all had leaders or managers that have stood out to us. Think of a leader or manager that stood out to you and share one thing about them.
Yeah, I remember him. His name is Jim Veraldi, one of the first companies I worked for. And there was two bosses, so to speak. There was the owner, but I reported to Jim. And the owner one day comes to me and goes, God, you're a loose cannon, Mike. I have pure frustration. And Jim comes to me and goes, yeah, you're a cannon for sure. This is the gunpowder we want to channel. And what he did, he reframed something that was, I think, intentionally meant to be negative and positioned it saying, ooh, when you have talent, maybe I'm not expressing it in the right way, it can be channeled in the right way. And became an extraordinary mentor for me during my employment there. And I'm forever grateful for that direction because I believe I have an energy or an ability that when channeled right can be of great service. And Jim was the first one to kind of put me in that direction.
Yeah, I love that. It's kind of one of those things where it's like, not everybody earlier in their career has a lot of professional skills or professional maturity.
Sure.
And sometimes we have to help them realize how to channel their energy, how to do certain things, because no one's taught them before. You've never been in a business environment until you're in a business environment. So help people succeed instead of just thinking of things of like, oh my gosh, that skill set, that quality, whatever it is, just needs to go away. Help people succeed. Help people do their best with what they have to offer.
Hashtag truth.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today on the Growing Your Team podcast.
Jamie, thank you.
Are you ready to hire a new team member for your business and you want to ensure you hire the person who can succeed in the role, make you happy, and positively impact your bottom line? Then let's talk and see how growing your team can help you master the art of hiring. Through bespoke hiring frameworks and comprehensive guidance, you will learn how to attract candidates who have the passion you desire and the skills needed to succeed. At Growing Your Team, women entrepreneurs and leaders work with us to help them expand their unique businesses by teaching them how to hire like a pro. Let's connect and see how we can help you. Send me an email at jamie@growingyourteam.com. That's Jamie, J-A-M-I-E, @growingyourteam.com, or head on over to growingyourteam.com/jumpstart, with jumpstart being all one word, and let's talk about how you can become a confident leader who hires right every single time.